Shalom, welcome to SJTF. This is Chaim ben Pesach. This program is dedicated to elevating the souls of Simcha Chasdai, Pesach ben Dov, Bari Hoffman, Ruven Hoffman, Meir ben Yecheskel, and Yosef ben Meir. Before we get to our many questions from our great JTFers, this was another very positive week, Baruch Hashem, thank God, for our Hebrew movement. For instance, 24 hours ago, I just uploaded a third article, a third column that I wrote for the Israeli website Yisraeli Patrioti, which means patriotic Israeli. It's a major Israeli website with 400,000 readers every month. 400,000 readers in a state of 6 million Jews. So that's a very big Israeli website. And you have Knesset members of the Knesset, the Israeli parliament, who submit articles there. All types of important people write for that particular website. And because of our growing movement and the attention that we're getting, I was invited to write a column for that website. And I've already written three different articles this month. So I submitted the third one, which you can see a review of it on a thread that I opened, the sticky thread that I opened on the English forum. And just to show you how much exposure we're getting, the second article that I wrote, not this past one, but the second article that I wrote, was also uploaded on their Facebook page. In other words, this website, Yisraeli Patrioti, also has a Facebook web page. And one of the administrators on their Facebook page uploaded my second article on their Facebook page, so it's also being exposed to the thousands of their Facebook readers. So we're reaching new people in different places and expanding our reach, and our message is getting across to different people in different places. And that's a major development, a very positive development. This particular week, we again did very well in terms of getting new members. We had 1,830 likes or members when we started our campaign on March 18th of this year. We started our advertising campaign for our Facebook Hebrew page. At that time, again, we had 1,830 likes, which is the equivalent of members on Facebook. The last time I looked, we had 6,299 likes. So that's more or less 6,300 likes. We went from 1,800 plus to about 6,300 likes. And that's since March 18th. So that's in less than 2 months. I think that's very, very impressive. We're continuing to grow, hundreds of new likes, hundreds of new members every week. And we had over 64,000 individual visitors last week, which is over 1% of Israel's Jewish population. Israel's Jewish population is about 6 million. We have 64,000 individual visitors now, just in the past week. So over 1% of Israel's Jewish population is now visiting our Hebrew Facebook page. But with all the good news about the Hebrew movement, as far as the English movement is concerned, I can't report the same type of good news, unfortunately. We're not growing in the same way with the English movement. Of course, we're not advertising with the English movement. We're not doing the same thing with the English movement that we're doing with the Hebrew movement, and that probably is the main reason, because we can't afford to advertise for both. But we need to expand and grow the English movement. We need to do that in order to back up the Hebrew movement. We need new sources of funding to keep up with this big growth we have on the Hebrew movement, because right now we've got about 6,300 members on the Hebrew Facebook page. So you figure we have about 6,300 members. We have over 60,000 visitors a week. So that's a substantial number of people are looking at our site and are being exposed to our message. But what's going to happen if we continue with this rate of growth? And if God willing, as we hope will occur, we eventually have 20,000, 30,000, 40,000, 50,000 members instead of 6,300 members. And eventually have hundreds of thousands of visitors on our page instead of 64,000. When that happens, we must have somebody in Israel full time working for us full time, to take care of that, to deal with that full time, because it's going to be a big movement with a lot of people, and you gotta have somebody full-time supervising that. Right now we have Hebrew admins who are working for us on a voluntary basis, and they put in long hours and are wonderful, dedicated people, but we've gotta have at least one person on staff full-time, eventually, in Israel, when we get to be really big. So that's something we have to plan for. Additionally, we want to increase our advertising. We're growing at the rate of hundreds of members a week, but we want to step up the rate of increase. We want to expand, and we want to reach many, many more people, because our goal is to become a mass movement. If we become a mass movement, we can change Jewish history. And our dream of becoming a positive force that will forever change history, our dream can be fulfilled if we become a mass movement. So the English movement is very important to us. It has to grow and gain new support, and we have to find new sources of funding in order to back up the Hebrew movement. And I'm only talking about the Hebrew movement. I'm not even speaking about the fact that on the English movement as well, we have things in the United States that we also want to accomplish. For instance, this November we have important elections coming up. We'd like to be able to reach a lot of people with our message on the upcoming elections this November. And of course, we want to be able to organize and have an impact on the 2016 presidential elections, and we want to have an impact on issues here in the United States that are of tremendous importance. So to do that, we have to grow our English movement as well. That has not really been happening, and that, I mean, we do have some growth in terms of the number of likes we have on our English Facebook page, that we do have. But that's mostly due to the efforts of people like Dan Ben Noach, for instance, who's been doing fantastic work there, and who's been giving a lot. Every time we have a cartoon that we put up, we get huge numbers of shares there, and I think that's because of Dan Ben Noach's wonderful hard work. But in terms of actual substantive growth in the English movement, I don't really see it the way we would hope that it would take place. So that's something we got to work on. The Hebrew movement, all I can tell you is, I still am rubbing my eyes in disbelief. I'm so happy with the results since we started the advertising campaign on March 18th. It's given me new hope that finally, we've always been looking for a way to reach large numbers of people. Finally, here we are, not only with the ability to reach large numbers of people, but with the ability to convince them to join us and to participate. We see this happening already and beginning to develop. The question is, will we have the funds to be able to deal with this giant thing that's growing? If this becomes a giant movement, right now it's getting bigger and bigger every week. If it becomes a giant movement, you know, we have to be able to run it effectively and efficiently. So that's a challenge. That's going to be a challenge for us. I hope that Hashem will help us, that God will help us find the new sources of funding that we need and find what we need to make these things happen. I hope so. I hope and pray, and we need your prayers to make that happen. But in the meantime, there are certain things you can do to help us. And those things, there are three main things that we mentioned. Actually, I'll make it four things, because we'll start off with prayers. We need your prayers. Pray to Hashem that we succeed, that our advertising campaign succeeds, that our efforts to wake the Jews of Israel up succeed, that everything we do to turn our movement in Israel into a mass movement succeeds, and that also leads to massive growth in our English movement, which is what we hope will happen if we have a mass movement in Israel. So please pray for our success. So much is riding on this. It's so important. Please pray for our success. Your prayers are very important to us. That's number one. Number two, when you see us upload articles, cartoons, videos on the English forum, when you see me come on with sticky threads, or even if the threads are not sticky, when you see me with threads showing you articles that I wrote, for instance, for this major Israeli website, or cartoons that our brilliant administrator Shlomo has done for us, or videos. When you see us doing that, please help us promote these things. Help us in the search engines. Help us promote these things. Like and share these things on Facebook and comment on them. On YouTube, of course, we need you to like and comment and favorite. And we need And of course, we need every other way that you can spread the word and have people go to these cartoons and videos and participate in it. So, because the more people we have, the greater our presence in the search engines, and it builds momentum. So we need your help with that. Please help us with that. And also, when I write articles, please go visit that page. Because if we have visitors going to that page, when you see that, like this new article that I just wrote in the past 24 hours for Patriotic Israeli, for Yisrael Patrioti, when we have new visitors going to the page, the more visitors we have, the more the owner of that particular website is going to want to put our articles on there. And the more prominence he'll display it with greater prominence when we have more visitors there. So please help us with that. Just visit the page. Even though the article is in Hebrew, just visit the page. Your visit helps. Okay, so that's number two. Okay, number one was prayers. Number two is help us spread the word when we have articles, cartoons, and videos. And number three, we need good posts on the forum and Facebook pages so that people will want to become active. And number four, last but not least, of course, checks, money orders, cash donations to the post office box make a huge difference. Every donation makes a big difference, enables us to advertise more, to reach more people, enables us to do what we have to do. And again, eventually we're going to have to have someone on staff in Israel as well. We're going to have to do that. In order to run this big and growing movement, we can't, you know, when it becomes really, really big, it'll just be too gigantic to run with volunteer administrators. That won't be enough. We're going to need at least one person on staff full time to coordinate everything and to make sure that that our Hebrew Facebook page is run properly, because it's becoming bigger and bigger. Baruch Hashem, thank God. So we need your help. We really need financial help very badly. This is something, we have a chance here to really make a change for the Jewish people and for Israel, which of course influences the redemption of the whole world. So help us participate in this. Every check and money order and cash donation sent to our post office box makes a big difference. And if you prefer, because it's more convenient, because you consider it to be more convenient to donate online. Some people prefer donating online. They consider that to be more convenient. Other people prefer to send it to the post office box. Whatever's more convenient for you. To us, it makes no difference. It's the same thing for us. But if you prefer to do it online, you can go to our donate button on our Hebrew main page on hayamin.org. There's a donate button in English on top. And in a couple of minutes, you can make a donation to our movement with your credit card. So, we need your help. This is a critical time for us, a very important time for us. And, you know, the things we've been dreaming about, the things we've been speaking about all these years, and our hopes and aspirations are on the line here. We have a chance now. We have a chance now. But we need everybody to pitch in and help us out. If we all work at this and we all pitch in and we all do what we can do to make a difference, Maybe, God willing, this is the time when we're finally going to be able to finish what our great leader, Rabbi Meir Kahana, Zecher Tzaddik V'Kadosh Livracha, Hashem Yikom Damo, started. If we can finish what Rabbi Kahana started, oh, what a better world this would be. What a great world this would become. God willing. Bezrat Hashem, God willing. Alevai, Alevai. Okay. So that's the news. I think it's overall, though, good news. The fact that our Hebrew movement is doing so well, that our Hebrew Facebook page is doing so well, I think is encouraging. But we got major challenges in terms of new sources of funding, and in terms of promoting things, and in terms of getting the English movement going as well, so that the English movement can back up the Hebrew movement. Those are still major challenges. But I think overall, I think the news is still pretty good. Pretty good, thank God. All right, let's go to our questions now from our great JTFers. And we start off with the great Wandering Samurai 81, who writes, and I quote, "You know, I always enjoy listening to you rant on self-hating Jews, so without further ado, please comment on these following Jews." Okay, and we have here four Jews that I absolutely can't stand, that you knew I'm not going to like, and you're right about that. Okay, we start off with Billy Crystal. Billy Crystal's a self-hating Jew who backs the anti-Semites, Bill and Hillary Clinton and Barack Hussein Obama, and backs all the leftists that are trying to destroy Israel. He's scum. He's scum. He has millions and millions of dollars that he's earned in the entertainment business, and he uses it for evil and not for good. He's scum. And then Wandering Samurai asks about Michael Bay. Michael Bay is a Jew who makes garbage Hollywood films. His films are so bad that even the pathetic Hollywood critics who like garbage usually, even they say that his films are garbage. Even the garbage Hollywood commentators say that his films are garbage. So in other words, his films are such garbage, or such low-level garbage, they don't even reach the level of garbage that is necessary to please the garbage Hollywood critics. That's Michael Bay and his films. He says he makes films for teenage boys, for the level of teenage boys. Now, the type of teenage boys that go to the movies today, you know, affirmative action morons, you can imagine what we're talking about. We're talking about people with very low IQs. And now, and by the way, I've never heard of anything that this guy has done with all the huge amount of money that he's made. And he's made a fortune. I have never heard of anything he's done to help the Jewish people with all that money. And now Wandering Samurai writes about Jeff Goldblum. Jeff Goldblum is a self-hating Jew who, just to show how self-hating he is, he's actually left the Jewish religion. He's left Judaism, even though he grew up in a home where he went to, he wasn't Orthodox, his home, they weren't Orthodox Jews, but he went to an Orthodox synagogue and was bar mitzvahed. I think he might have been bar mitzvahed in an Orthodox synagogue, but he went to an Orthodox synagogue when he was younger. But he's left Judaism and intermarried. He was intermarried, of course. And now he follows Eastern religions, Far Eastern religions. So he doesn't even follow Judaism anymore. He's now following other religions. He's left the Jewish faith. That's Jeff Goldblum. And finally, Jerry Stiller. Wandering Samurai asked me about Jerry Stiller. Well, people in my generation would be more familiar with him. He's an 86-year-old trader who intermarried in 1954. 1954 he intermarried. Now, that was a time when only 2 or 3% of American Jews were intermarrying. Very few American Jews intermarried at that time, maybe 3%. 97% of American Jews married their fellow Jews in those days, in the 1950s. But he was one of the trailblazers who said to Jews, no, you don't have to do that. You can intermarry. You can marry outside the Jewish faith, which, of course, we know what the destructive effect has been for American Jewry. We have a spiritual holocaust going on in the United States. American Jewry is literally disappearing, completely disappearing because of intermarriage and assimilation. And he was one of the people that led that. I remember all the shows he did on Ed Sullivan. He came on with his non-Jewish wife and joking about how nice it is when they have an interfaith marriage and so on and so forth. Who knows how many Jewish souls he destroyed by legitimizing this type of assimilation. And now his son, of course, is Ben Stiller. He's a leftist. And he strongly supports Barack Hussein Obama, Hillary Clinton, John Kerry, although he complained about Obama recently because Obama's not left-wing enough for him, he claimed. I don't know. I think if Obama got any more left-wing, I think he'd fall off the face of the earth. If he went any further to the left, I think he would fall right off the face of the earth, which is a nice thought, by the way. But anyway, Ben Stiller was a strong supporter of Obama and Clinton and John Kerry and all the other Jew haters. That's the son of Jerry Stiller. Thank you, Wandering Samurai. And we now go to our great friend Joe Gutfeld, who writes, and I quote, Shalom Chaim. Last week, a neighbor, quote unquote, wrote on my door that I'm gay, which I'm not. Can you curse them for me? Thanks, unquote. Well, Joe, I don't know this neighbor and I don't know the circumstances. I'm sure, by the way, that this was terrible if this person did this and disgusting, and it's a terrible sin. But before I actually curse somebody, cursing is a very serious thing when you curse somebody. I would say this to you, what they did is a terrible sin. There's no question about it. And you know the circumstances involving this. If they wrote it on your door as graffiti, as as a form of vandalism, you know, that's illegal. I mean, you can file a complaint against them. You can go to the police if you know that they wrote this as a form of graffiti or vandalism. You can go to the police, and it's actually a hate crime. The minute you bring up the word gay, it becomes a hate crime. So, you know, I think this is something where you can, if again, of course, the issue comes up, can you prove that it's your neighbor, which is another good question, but if you can offer a compelling argument that this is your neighbor, you might be able to get them into trouble for what they did, which they certainly deserve. If they're doing this type of thing to you, they certainly deserve that. I hope that God brings you justice, and I hope that those who do injustice to you will pay a price for it. May they pay a price for all the injustice they're doing to you, Joe. That I will say. Thank you, Joe. And now we go to the great Dr. Dan, the voice of reason, common sense, and logic, who writes, and I quote, "How should we Jews observe Yom HaZikaron, Yom HaAtzmaut, and Yom HaShoah? Which of Kahana's speeches are appropriate to reflect on these 3 days?" Unquote. Okay, great question. Yom HaZikaron is the day when we remember the Jews, and the Jewish soldiers and Jewish civilians who fell, who were murdered in Israel's wars and in acts of terrorism, in the 100-year-plus war of the Arab world and the Muslim world to destroy Israel and destroy the Jewish people. It's an important day. I do think the Jews should celebrate that day. And when I say celebrate, I mean commemorate that day and remember the Jews who gave their lives so that we could have a Jewish homeland. Absolutely. As far as Yom HaAtzmaut, Independence Day, absolutely. Absolutely, we should be commemorating that day. That's a day we should be celebrating. That's a wonderful day on the Jewish calendar. Because Yom HaAtzmaut, the day of when Israel achieved her independence again, even though the leaders of Israel were evil traitors, nevertheless, the fact that there was a Jewish state, the fact that we had Jewish sovereignty again after 2,000 years, was a tremendous act of redemption and a tremendous step toward the final redemption of the world. So that's a very important day for the Jewish people. And Yom HaShoah is the commemoration, the day when we commemorate the Holocaust, when over 6 million of our brothers and sisters were brutally murdered by the German Nazi beasts. We have to remember what was done to over 6 million Jews, Hashem Yikom Damam, which means may their blood be avenged. Absolutely, we can never forget. We have to remember the lessons of the Holocaust, and we should reflect on the lessons of the Holocaust. Rabbi Kahana made many speeches. I don't know specifically which speech to match with each of these things, but he's made many speeches and his whole philosophy are very relevant to all 3 of these days. His books, his speeches, the videos we see, there are many things that he says that are relevant to all 3 of these important days on the Jewish calendar. Thank you very much, Dr. Dan. And now we go to the great Lewinsky Stinks, Dr. Brennan Rocks, who writes, and I quote, "Discuss the following Torah saints, Alan Sobrowski and Adam Shapiro," unquote. Well, Lewinsky Stinks is being sarcastic here. Alan Sobrowski, first of all, Alan Sobrowski says he's not Jewish, and he isn't, and he's right, he's not Jewish, because he had just one self-hating grandfather who was a Jew. 3 out of his 4 grandparents were not Jewish. Just one grandfather was a Jew. And under Jewish law, it's the mother. You have to have a Jewish mother to be Jewish. Either have a Jewish mother or convert according to halacha, convert according to Orthodox Jewish law. One of those 2. Otherwise, you cannot be a Jew. Now, he had one self-hating grandfather who was a Jew, so he correctly says he's not Jewish. His other 3 grandparents were not. But he uses the fact that he nevertheless has some type of connection to the Jewish people because of the Jewish grandfather. He uses that to hurt Israel and the Jewish people because he's a Nazi Jew hater. This is a Nazi Jew hater who blames 9/11 on the Israeli Mossad. Imagine the Israelis doing 9/11. I mean, it's just so sick. Our enemies, who want to exterminate us carry out these brutal acts of mass murder, and then we get blamed for it. I mean, where can you get a worse type of Nazi injustice and Nazi anti-Semitism than that? And that's what this piece of subhuman garbage does. He's the scum of the earth. The scum of the earth. May he die a very violent death. And Adam Shapiro, that's another one who deserves to die in a very violent death. Yimach shmo v'zichro, shem reshaim yirkav. This beast, another Nazi, he actually halachically was Jewish, even though now he says he's not Jewish. He says he doesn't consider himself to be Jewish, which is fine. Who the hell wants him? This Nazi pig organizes groups like the International Solidarity Movement, that's a group that he co-founded, which openly works for Israel's destruction. He's married to an Arab Jew hater who calls herself a Palestinian. There are no Palestinians. There is no Palestine. There are no Palestinians. But anyway, he's married to one of these Arab Jew haters that wants to destroy Israel. And he works obsessively to destroy his own people. The scum of the earth. Absolute. You know, and as we used to say on our JTF television programs, it's an insult to scum to call him scum. Now Lewinsky stinks ass and writes, and I quote, are the Jews behind Jewish, quote-unquote, American Heritage Month also supporters of Middle East Heritage Month, unquote? Oh, indubitably. That's a fancy word. Undoubtedly, in other words. Indubitably. There's no question about it that the type of Jews who support the so-called Jewish American Heritage Month, the only Jews, by the way, that they honor on Jewish American Heritage Month, of course, are self-hating Jewish traitors. Obama Jews, all the self-hating rats, all the intermarried assimilated rats that stab their own people in the back. Those are the people that are honored on the so-called Jewish American Heritage Month. And of course, those types of people also support Middle East Heritage Month. They support any month or any event that helps their enemies. That's what they do. That is the nature of their being. That's the nature of the beast. Absolutely. Thank you, Lewinsky Stinks. And we now go on to the great EB22, who writes, and I quote, please discuss your thoughts about the following three New York Democrat congressional representatives, unquote. Before I get to these three, I just want to say, people ask me about, if you notice, I was asked about the various Jewish, self-hating Jewish figures and other people I've been asked about so far. Everybody I'm being asked about, these are all evil people. I mean, I don't hate everybody, but it just happens to be that the people I'm being asked about usually on the program happen to be very evil people. So I just want people to understand why I've got to give an honest answer. I don't want to sound like I'm negative and like I hate everybody, but you know, the people that I'm being asked about, if somebody's a self-hating Jew, and if you have a Jew who wants Israel to commit suicide and hates Israel and wants to destroy Israel and supports Obama and Hillary Clinton and all the other Jew haters, and is a leftist piece of garbage, of course I'm going to despise people like that. And now EB22 asks about the following three congressmen, Democrat congressmen from New York. One, Hakeem Jeffries. Ugh, what a piece of trash. First of all, look at that Arabic Muslim name that he has, Hakeem Jeffries. Yeah. I mean, how disgusting. Of course, he supports all the black anti-Semites. He supports Al Sharpton. He supports Barack Hussein Obama, supports Jesse Jackson, supports all the black anti-Semites, and is in with the Congressional Black Caucus, which marches in Louis Farrakhan's Million Man March. So, you know, he's a Jew hater, as would be expected. And by the way, how did he get ahead? He got ahead because he started out in a law firm dominated by self-hating Jewish lawyers who gave him promotions and jobs that he never deserved. All the self-hating Jews push him forward, and then he works to destroy the Jewish people. Isn't that a wonderful story? Isn't that a lovely story? And the next Democrat congressman is Tim Bishop, that I'm being asked about from the great EB22, is Tim Bishop. Tim Bishop is a left-wing Democrat congressman from Suffolk County. He's just a typical left-wing Democrat. He's a political prostitute. He's a phony and an individual with no principles. Typical, just a regular, he's your regular run-of-the-mill, standard left-wing Democrat. And finally, three, Nita Lowey. Ugh, Oh, she's a horror. She's from Westchester County. She used to be my congresswoman, this hideous animal. Anyway, she's a self-hating Jewish supporter, of course, of Bill Clinton and Hillary Clinton and Barack Hussein Obama and all the enemies of Israel and the Jewish people. She supports all of them. Every time there's an issue that comes up about something that they're doing against Israel, she's there to defend all the Jew haters. I'm a Jewish congresswoman and I'm supporter of Israel. Yeah, sure. She's a supporter of Israel with friends like her. Who needs Arafat? Anyway, she says, no, Barack Hussein Obama is wonderful for Israel. And all of them, they're all wonderful. John Kerry, great, great friend of Israel. Hillary Clinton. I mean, she's such, what a Judenrat piece of trash. Thank you, EB22. And we now go to Righteous Sword, who is new to our forum. Welcome to our forum, Righteous Sword. Righteous Sword writes, and I quote, does JTF work with Baruch Marzel or Noam Federman, unquote. I did give tens of thousands of dollars in the past to Baruch Marzel when he was running for the Israeli Knesset, the Israeli parliament. And then for some reason, 8 years ago, this was a long time ago, and then for some reason, 8 years ago, Baruch Marzel started attacking me, started saying terrible things about me. Why? I don't know. And I don't even want to, you know, I have spoken about what he said, and I've done videos about what he said. I don't want to go into all the detail, but he's attacked me, is continuing to attack to this day, and his supporters are continuing to this day. We want to work with everybody. We want unity. We want an end to the attacks. We want an end to this. We put our hand out, a hand of friendship and brotherhood to all of our fellow Jews who are willing to work for the future of Israel. We extend the hand of friendship and brotherhood, but the only answer we've gotten is just hate, 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 hate. And so, what can I say? If Baruch Marzel wants to stop attacking, and if he wants to talk about how we can cooperate to try to save Israel, we'll, you know, we will cooperate with even with people that we don't like. And I don't particularly like Baruch Marzel after all the things that he's done. But even with people that we don't particularly like, we'll still work with them. If it's good for the Jewish people and good for Israel, we'll work with Baruch Marzel. We want to cooperate. We want an end to this. He's still though, making these attacks on us and saying terrible things. What can I say? I think it's unfortunate. I think it's unfortunate. So no, we do not work with Baruch Marzel for many years now. We did give him money in the past. We gave him a lot of money. And I did videos proving that we gave him money. I showed the checks, and I showed the Western Union. I showed Western Union where we transferred over $20,000 to Baruch Marzel's to help elect Baruch Marzel to the Knesset. So I tried my best to help him when he was running for the Knesset. I think when someone tries to help you who doesn't even know you, because he thinks you're a Kahanist and because he's just trying to help you, I would think you would be grateful. I would think you would say, you know, thank you, and by the way, I don't want a thank you from him. I don't request a thank you from him. That I never wanted. I never requested that. But he started attacking. He started attacking us after we helped him and after we supported him. I mean, I just couldn't understand it. So let's hope that stops. We extend the hand of friendship, and we want to work and cooperate with every one of our fellow Jews who are willing to work to help save Israel. If Baruch Marzel is willing to do that and is willing to change and willing to stop attacking for no reason, just attack us all the time for no reason, despite everything that he's done, and I think he's done some bad things to us, we're willing to forget about that, put that aside, and cooperate for the good of Israel. As far as Noam Federman is concerned, we did work with Noam Federman for many years. Noam Federman is not at all like Baruch Marzel. Noam Federman is a very good Jew who I have only positive things to say about him. He's a wonderful Jewish hero. We have not worked with him for several years, and I haven't been in touch with him for several years, but he is a very good Jew. We did work with him in the past. We did help him in the past, but we have not been in touch with him for several years. Thank you very much, Righteous Sword. I hope that answers your question. And now we go to the great Yemach Shmo Tu Jabnik, who writes, and I quote, Maimonides Zatzal said Islam is a monotheistic religion and happened to admire it more than Christianity. From what I've read, he even wrote there is nothing wrong about Jews converting to Islam since they would still remain Jewish. Is this particular statement true? What do you think caused Maimonides, one of the greatest Jewish scholars, to hold such an opinion? Was he not aware of the genocidal anti-Jewish texts that exist in Quran and Hadith, or that Muhammad himself was a Jew-killing terrorist who slaughtered and enslaved thousands of Jews? Was there ever a rabbi or Talmudic scholar in history attempted to court Islam for a Nazi religion? For a Nazi religion it is. Also, what did Rabbi Kahana Zatzal think of Islam? Unquote. First of all, I don't know, Yamash Motajavnik, I don't know where you're getting this information from. But it's a complete distortion of what Maimonides wrote. Maimonides, Harambam, Maimonides wrote that Muhammad, the founder of Islam, was meshuga, was a madman, was a lunatic. That's what he wrote. He called him a lunatic, a madman. Ha meshuga, he called him, the crazy one, the lunatic. So I don't know where you're getting this from. Now, what he did say is this. You know, we have a concept in Judaism where to save your life, we have 613 commandments, but you can violate the commandments if it'll save your life. For instance, if you have to break the Sabbath in order to save your life, you're not allowed to break the Sabbath laws, of course, and you must eat kosher, and you must do many other things in Judaism. But if it's a matter of life and death, to save your life, you're permitted. You're permitted to violate the commandments only if it's a matter of life and death to save your life. You're permitted to do it. Except for three commandments. Three out of the 613 commandments, you are not allowed to violate, even if your life is in danger, even if it means that you have to give your life. And those three commandments, one of those three commandments is Avodah Zarah. Avodah Zarah means idolatry. You are not allowed to bow before idols or believe in idolatry or accept idolatry. You're not allowed to even fake it and pretend that you believe in idolatry to save your life. If someone says, bow before this idol or I'll kill you, even if you don't believe in the idol, even if you're just faking it because you want to live, because you want to save your life, you're not allowed to do that. You're supposed to say, no, I refuse to do it, and be willing to give your life, al kiddush Hashem. You're not allowed to engage in idolatry in Avodah Zarah. That's one of the three commandments that we're not allowed under any circumstances to violate. Even on pain of death. Now, what Maimonides said was, he said that the Muslims were going to Jews with putting a sword to their neck and saying, you're going to have to say, Muhammad, there is no God but Allah, and Muhammad is his servant. And Muhammad is his prophet, which is the Islamic saying. And they were going to Jews and saying, we're going to cut your throat, we're going to kill you. If you're not willing to say, there is no God but Allah, and Muhammad is his servant. Maimonides said that you're allowed to save your life, you're allowed to say that phrase, there is no God but Allah and Muhammad is his servant. You're allowed to say it to save your life, even though the phrase is a lie, and there's no question Muhammad is not a servant of God. Muhammad was a lunatic and an evil murdering beast. And there's no question that the Muslim religion is a religion of lies and falsehood and hatred and mass murder. But according to Maimonides, according to Harambam, it is not idolatry, it is not Avodah Zarah. As long as it is not Avodah Zarah, to save your life, you're allowed to repeat that phrase or to do what you have to do to save your life when it comes to Islam. Islam is not idolatrous and it doesn't fall into the category of an idolatrous religion where you have to be willing to die. Rather than in any way even pretend to accept it. Okay, that's what Maimonides said. And by the way, there are rabbis who disagree with Maimonides and who say Islam is also an idolatrous religion. And that there were rabbis who said you are not allowed to say that to save your life. But this is not some theoretical issue here. We were sitting and debating in some university setting or some other nice little place. This was not a theoretical issue. This was an issue where men, women, and children and their families were facing extermination, were facing being brutally murdered. And they had to make a decision. Do we allow ourselves and our women and our children to be murdered? Or are we willing to say this one statement that the Muslims are demanding that we say that there is no God but Allah and Muhammad is his prophet? Are we willing to say that? again, Maimonides said that Islam, he said Islam is an evil religion, it's a false religion, it's a lying religion, but, they do believe in one God, and because they believe in one God, it doesn't matter what they call the God, they believe in one God, and because they believe in just one God, it's not idolatry. It's not idolatry. So to save your life, you can say that phrase if it will save your life. That's what he said. And again, there were rabbis who there's a machloket on that. There's a disagreement on that. There were rabbis who said, no, even to save your life, you can't do that because Islam is in fact idolatrous. But anyway, that is what he said. He never said that Jews can convert to Islam, God forbid. God forbid he never said. First of all, Jews are not allowed to convert to any other religion. And there's no way Maimonides or any Jewish sage would ever sanction converting to any other religion under any circumstances. There is no way. You also write that he admires Christianity. He writes about it with contempt. You say he admires it more than Christianity. He writes about Islam. You say he admires it more than Christianity. He writes about Islam with contempt. In fact, he says, when he was asked, they wrote to him and asked him, are we allowed to have religious debates with Christians and are we allowed to have religious debates with Muslims? And this is what Maimonides said. He said, with Christians, you can have a religious debate. Why? Because Christians, even though we have differences in our interpretation, at least Christians accept the basis. They accept they accept the Jewish Bible, the Torah, as given to us by God. That they accept. And so there is some basis. There's a foundation, at least, to debate upon, because they do accept the foundation. But he said, Islam, there's nothing to debate about. We can't debate with them. There's nothing to say to the Muslims. We have nothing to say to them in terms of any debating, religious debating. Because they don't even accept the foundation. They say the Torah and the Bible and everything is all a lie. Only the Quran and only what Muhammad said is true. Everything else is a lie. That's what Islam teaches. So he said there's not even a basis to debate the Muslims. Whereas with the Christians, he said there is a basis. We're allowed to debate the Christians theologically because there's a basis that we mutually, that there's a foundation there that a mutual foundation which we can debate upon. Or which based upon that foundation we can have an intelligent discussion. But with Islam, he said there's nothing to discuss. Well, what is there to discuss? They say everything we say, they say is a lie. And in fact, everything they say in the Quran is a lie. So what is there to debate about? That's what he said about Islam. So again, to take the one thing he said about to save your life, you're allowed to make that one statement, and that Islam is not idolatry, to take that and extend it to what you've written here is completely untrue. Maimonides despised Islam and despised Muhammad and again called him Hameshuga, the madman. Maimonides, by the way, never didn't use his name, didn't even refer to him as Muhammad. He referred to him as Hameshuga, the madman. That's admiring him? That's admiring the religion? Of course Maimonides was aware of what's written. You don't think Maimonides was a genius? Have you ever seen Guide to the Perplexed and the books that he wrote? He was a genius. He was one of the greatest geniuses in history. You think he would make statements about Islam without reading the Quran and the Hadith and knowing what it says? He knew it inside, outside better than the Muslims. So he knew what an insane, evil, bloodthirsty religion this was. Of course he knew that. Of course he knew that. You also asked what Rabbi Kahana thought of Islam. He thought the same thing of Islam as any other rabbi, any other normal sane rabbi would think, which is that this is a murderous, evil, barbaric, terrorist religion founded by a barbaric, murdering, raping, pedophile beast. That's what Rabbi Kahana thought, and that's a fact. It's a historical fact that is what Islam represents. Thank you, Yimach Shmo to Jobnik, and we now go to our great friend Mansch, who writes, and I quote, Second Lebanon War, Israel Air Force flew 12,000 missions, 1973 war, over 12,000 missions. I think that means 12,000 missions, 1973 war, 11,000, 82 Lebanon, 6,000 Israel, artillery fired 170,000 shells, twice the number in 73 war defeated. What do you think is the difference? Okay, great question. And you're absolutely right. Israel had all the characteristics of being the ultimate, history's ultimate underdog in the 1967 war, and then you didn't mention 1967. In the 1967 war, in the 1973 war, and all these wars, Israel was the ultimate underdog and won spectacular, miraculous, incredible, breathtaking victories against the whole Arab world. In the 1967 war, it was against the whole Arab world. How did this happen? That in the Lebanon war, when they were just fighting against, in the second Lebanon war, when they're just fighting against a ragtag army of Hezbollah terrorists, they couldn't defeat a ragtag army of Hezbollah terrorists? The Israeli army couldn't defeat them? The same Israeli army that defeated the whole Arab world, that defeated Arab armies that were dozens upon dozens of times the size of the Jewish army? This incredible Israeli army that did such miraculous things in the Six-Day War and the Yom Kippur War and all the other wars, and they couldn't defeat a ragtag group of Hezbollah cowardly terrorists who hide behind women and children? How's that possible? And the answer is because they didn't want to win in the Lebanon War. The people running Israel are now traitors who are convinced that if Israel wins, it's bad. Because then Israel looks, because then, oh, they're going to say, how dare you win? That's not nice to win wars. This is literally their mentality. They want the world to cry over us, and they want us to be victims again. They think that this is the way that we're supposed to be going. Instead of being strong, they think that weakness is going to be better for Israel. They think it's a weak Israel. They believe a small Israel, a weak Israel, a vulnerable Israel, an Israel that is dependent slavishly upon U.S. foreign aid. This is the Israel that they believe in. They believe that that's an Israel that the world will accept. But a strong, independent, vibrant, winning Israel, that's terrible. That they won't accept. That the world will get mad at us if we do that. That's the mentality of these people. That's the mentality of the people who are running Israel. And that's what the enemies of Israel tell the Jews all the time. So the enemies of Israel have convinced them. The enemies of Israel say all the time, if you want to be accepted, you've got to have a so-called Palestinian state. You've got to go back to the pre-67 borders. You've got to go back to borders that are 6 to 9 miles wide. You've got to give up Jerusalem, your capital, and Judea and Samaria, and surrender everything. You're not allowed to defend yourself. This is what our enemies tell us. This is what the European Union and Obama and the UN and the whole world tell us all the time. And they've convinced the leaders of Israel that this is true. By the way, even if it was true that this is the only thing the world will accept, screw them. Who cares what the world will accept? Israel has to do what Israel has to do to survive. That's number one. Number two, it isn't true. If anything, we were far better respected when we won big victories like in 1967, 1973. The world respects winners. The world respects little Israel when she wins spectacular victories. But the leaders of Israel, they're incapable of winning now. They're incapable of winning. They can't. They have a defeatist mentality that is beyond explanation. It's so insane, it's beyond explanation. Also, the Hezbollah terrorists hide behind women and children. And the Israeli army was told, oh, you can't. No, there are civilians. You can't. You're not allowed to. So the Hezbollah, they could keep firing. You know, the missions that you're talking about here, they were bombing mostly empty spaces and empty buildings and empty areas. They wanted to make sure. They warned people in advance to leave before they would bomb. And so they'd bomb empty areas. So bombing missions were a complete waste. All the artillery and all the other things you're mentioning here, it was a complete waste. The fact is, Israel needs leaders who will understand that the Arab civilians support the Arab terrorists. They are also the enemy. And therefore, when the Arab terrorists hide among the Arab civilians, that should not be, they should not be able to be protected by that. Jewish lives come first. Muslim lives, the lives of our enemies, are not on the same level and are not to be valued as the way Jewish lives are to be valued. And until we have leaders that understand that and that are willing to go in and slaughter the terrorists, slaughter them. When we have leaders that do that, then we'll win, and we'll win very fast. And not let, and I would not, if I were prime minister, not a single Jewish soldier, not a single Jew would be sacrificed in order to save the lives of Arab so-called civilians. Not one. We would go in and bomb, and we wouldn't give them warning. We would go in and blow them to pieces. And strike at them, and strike at them the way you're supposed to strike in a war. Strike to win and cause as much damage as you can cause. And liberate parts of the land of Israel that are part of so-called Lebanon now, and that we would do that as well. We would absolutely annihilate the Hezbollah terrorists and the other terrorists if we were in power. You give us the power. And Obama won't like us, and the UN won't like us. That's true. The UN will condemn us, and Obama will condemn us, and the European Union will condemn us, and they'll say they're going to have boycotts and this and that against us. That's all true. Yeah, that's true. That will happen. Yes, that will happen. But Jews will not be murdered anymore, because the terrorists are going to be dead. Jews will not be murdered. Arab terrorists won't be released anymore, because we're going to execute all of them. And Jews will not be murdered anymore. Jews will be safe in their homeland, and we'll have a liberated economy and a free people with real competition. And we'll teach Jews why our fight is a just fight and why their fight is an evil war. And we are completely justified in destroying every attempt that they make to go after us and to commit genocide against us. That's the Israel we're going to have. We're going to have an Israel where Jews are safe again in their homeland, and when no one dares to start with the Jewish people. They're going to learn, the Arabs and Muslims will still hate us, but they will see that there is such a terrible price to pay when they try to even lift a finger against the Jew. There is such a price to pay that will be a deterrent, and that will protect the Jewish people in their homeland. Thank you, Mensch. And we now go to our great friend Kalman Ben Menachem, who writes, and I quote, "Reb Chaim, what do you think of New Jersey federal judge Harvey Sorokin? Thank you," unquote. Kalman, unfortunately, I don't know anything about him. I have no idea. I don't know enough about him to say. This is one of the people that I just don't know enough about. I'm sorry, Kalman. I don't know anything about him. Thank you, Kalman. And we now go to the great Binyamin Yisrael, who writes, and I quote, "Jericho was the first city liberated by Joshua. It was the first city surrendered in Oslo. It's also the oldest city in the world. I hate the Bolshevik surrender. There was a national park at the archaeological tell there, and I never go to see it. I'm sure the Arabs removed all Hebrew writings. Is there ever a chance that any Israeli government will liberate any occupied parts of Yesha and reestablish historic sites other than a Kahanist government? Do you think the Oslo criminals specifically picked to surrender Jericho first because they hate the Bible," unquote. Okay. I think if it's not a Kahanist government, I think the only way an Israeli government would liberate, of course, if we're in power, we will liberate all of Judea and Samaria once again. But if there's not a Kahanist government there, I think the only way you get an Israeli government to do that is if they're forced to do it like they were in 1967. If Hashem forces them to, if God forces them to, then they'll do it. If they're constant attacks and they feel there's no choice and they have to do it, then they'll do it, only if they're forced to. We, on the other hand, will go in and we will liberate it before any Jewish blood is spilled. We will go in and liberate our homeland and liberate those sections of the land of Israel that were under our control after the 1967 Six-Day War, but that were surrendered under the Oslo treasonous accords. which of course the Arabs have completely violated everything, and there are no Oslo Accords anymore, and there's no reason why Israel shouldn't go in and just liberate these areas again and say, this is ours, goodbye. That's it. We're taking over again. You broke your word, you murdered all these Jews, you committed all these acts of terrorism, screw you. That's what we're going to do if we take power. But if it's a non-Kahanist government, the only way they would do it is if they're forced to. Did the Oslo criminals specifically surrender Jericho first because they hate the Bible? There's no question that a lot of their calculations were based upon their hatred of the Bible. Yitzhak Rabin and the other criminals of Oslo did, in fact, one of the things they wanted to do was surrender Jewish holy places to the Muslims as quickly as possible because they want to destroy the Jewish religious connection to the land of Israel. And that is because of their hatred of the Torah and hatred of the Bible. Yes, that played a role, a major role. Thank you, Binyamin. And we now go to our friend Russian Leo 777, who writes, and I quote, "There is a so-called museum of sex in Manhattan that's pretty much all pornography and has a section displaying Anthony Weiner's sexting. How sick," unquote. Well, it certainly is very sick. I mean, you mean somebody wants to see that? How disgusting. I mean, who would want to see Anthony Weiner? He thought all the women wanted to see him. He thought all these women just can't wait to see him. I mean, you know, talk about somebody living in a world of delusion. Anyway, it is unbelievable. But Museum of Sex, it's degeneracy. These are degenerates. And this is all degeneracy. It's a sick world, and it's getting sicker. And God willing, hopefully good people will get enough power to turn the situation around. Thank you, Russian Leo. And we now go to the great LKZ, who writes, and I quote, "Why do we say the same prayers every day?" unquote. Okay, that's a great question. And the answer is, there are a number of answers, but one of them is that these prayers are specifically worded in a way that makes us aware of what we're supposed to be requesting from God. And let's understand who created these prayers for us. They were created by Torah sages in the Second Temple, what we call Knesset HaGedolah. Knesset HaGedolah were the 120 Torah sages during the time of the Second Temple. And in the days of the Second Temple, by the way, there were still prophets. There were still those who actually still received messages from God. Prophets in their dreams actually were, God actually spoke to the prophets. And so we still had prophets. And we haven't had prophets for many, many years now, for thousands of years. But we still, in the time of the Second Temple, we still had prophecy. And we still had sacrifices. So this was a time when Jews were at a very high level spiritually, and prophets were part of Knesset HaGedolah. There were actually several prophets who were part of the 120 Chachamim, the 120 wise Torah sages in Knesset Gedolah, Knesset HaGedolah. And so they're the one, this is where we got the basis, this is where this prayer started. This is where these prayers started, the Shmona Esrei. Started there. The Shmona Esrei are the 18 requests that we make to Hashem, and it's really 19. They added a 19th request when they cursed all the Jewish traitors and the self-hating Jews. There's a special prayer against the Jewish informers and the self-hating Jews. That's the 19th prayer. But we still call it the Shmona Esrei. We still call it 18, even though there are 19 requests we make three times a day. And this is all the language that's used in these prayers. Is specifically the type of language that, of course, when we're praying to God, God doesn't need our prayers. We need to pray to God. This is important for us, for our soul, to understand that God is the ruler of the universe, to understand that all of our blessings come from God, to understand that we're in this world to discover and have knowledge of God, and to serve God, and to do whatever God commands us to do. That's our purpose in life. And so these prayers are very important to us. When we recite these prayers, it's very important to us because it focuses us on what we're supposed to be requesting from God, and then it becomes part of our soul, and we do begin to request this every day and understand the importance of it, and becomes part of our soul after a while. So that's why it's important that we have these prayers every day. And let's see. And now LKZ writes, and I quote, "Is there something inherently special about Shema, or is it what you think that counts?" Unquote. No, there is something very inherently special about the Shema. Shema is the prayer we say, "Hear, O Israel, the Lord is our God, the Lord is one." No, there's something very, very important. We're affirming and recognizing God's absolute authority in the world and the absolute oneness of God. And his, the complete oneness of God and his absolute authority. And why following him is what's important in the world. Following God and believing in God and acknowledging God, that's what's important in life. That's what's important in the world. That's what brings blessings, and that's what's important in life. That is why we were brought into this world, to understand that. God wants to give us the greatest possible good. And the greatest possible good is God himself. God himself is the greatest possible good. Knowing God himself, that is the greatest possible good. Knowing him and following him and doing what he commands us to do, that's the greatest possible good. When we discover that and fully understand what that means, then we've understood the true secret of life. We've unlocked the true secret of life. When we understand that God is the ultimate good, and that if we want the ultimate good, God himself is the ultimate good. And he wants to give us the ultimate good, which is understanding and having knowledge of him. Then we have truly discovered in a general way the true secret of life, the true secrets of life. And of course, we have to also understand the specifics of that, what that means in every way, in terms of the commandments, in terms of what we do on a day-to-day basis. We have to, and how it relates to our relationship with other people and with the world and with our land, our homeland and everything else. We have to understand all of that. But that's the secret of life, is understanding that God is the greatest good, and that knowledge of him and following what he says and following his commandments and submitting our will to his will, understanding that his will is what should be guiding us, that is the greatest good. We're not doing him any favors. We can't do him any favors. He's perfect. He has everything. There's nothing we can do for him. Everything we do when we follow his will is for our own benefit. And the Shema is our affirmation and recognition of that reality. And now LKZ writes, "Why do we put tefillin on daily?" Unquote. Well, the tefillin tie us to God and his mitzvot. It gives us the spiritual, giving us a spiritual jump start in the day. It ties us to him. It ties us to him in two ways. We have tefillin shel rosh, which means the tefillin that we put on our head, right? That's for our spiritual connection. That's in our head and our mind to be spiritually connected to God, to always be connected to God, to always want to seek and have knowledge of God and understand his commandments. And then we have tefillin shel yad, the tefillin of the hand. And that's symbolizing our actions in the world, the importance of the actions that we take in the world. So it's important. Thank you, LKZ. Great questions. And we now go to our great friend Chicago Jew, who writes, and I quote, "How much were the Jews responsible for MLK, Martin Luther King?" To a great degree. They played a major role. They played a major role. Jews gave a lot of money to the civil rights movement. A huge percentage of those who marched and who participated in the civil rights movement were Jews. And the people who gave him the positive news media coverage and other coverage, you know, a lot of them were Jewish reporters and Jewish journalists and Jewish editors, played a huge role in promoting Martin Luther King. The Jewish organizations played a huge role in helping Martin Luther King. And contrary to what everybody else says, I believe Martin Luther King's influence on America was a disaster, was terrible for America. Thank you, Chicago Jew. And we now go to our great friend Da Vinci, who writes, and I quote, "Is intermarriage between Muslims and non-Muslims an Islamic tactic to destroy a society from within?" Unquote. Absolutely. Absolutely. Muslims do seek, especially Muslim men, seek out non-Muslim wives. And then, of course, they convert them to Islam. But that is something that they do set out to do. There's no question about that. That is a major aspect of their effort to expand the Islamic religion, to humiliate the non-Muslims, and to increase their control over increase their influence and control even in non-Muslim countries. That's a major aspect of their strategy. Always was. Very, very true, Da Vinci. Very, very true. Thank you, Da Vinci. And we now go to the great Nekama, who writes, and I quote, "What's all the fuss about Boko Haram? This group is just emulating the most perfect person to ever live, Muhammad," unquote. Very, very true, Nekama. As always, very, very true. There's no question that Muhammad also kidnapped and raped and murdered schoolgirls. And this is something Muhammad did all the time. Muhammad married Aisha. That was his last wife, Aisha. She was 6 years old when they got married. He was in his 50s and she was 6 years old. And they had sexual relations when she was 9 years old, according to the hadith. So this is a guy in his 50s having relations with a 9-year-old girl. And of course, he did rape women. He was a pedophile and a rapist. He was a mass murderer. He beheaded men and boys just because they were Jewish. He lied and cheated. He signed peace treaties and broke them just like the Arabs and the Muslims do today. He had a peace treaty with the tribe Quraysh and then staged a surprise attack against them. And the Quran and the Hadith actually brag about it. Oh, the Prophet fooled them. Ha ha ha. You know, they actually brag about it. They think it's something to brag about, being a sneaky backstabber. They think that this is something to emulate. They think this is wonderful. Muhammad himself told the Muslims to engage in taqiyah, to engage in deception with the non-Muslim infidels. So you're right. I don't know why they're making such a big deal about Boko Haram. They're true Muslims. They're behaving like true Muslims. Thank you, Nekama. And now we go to our great friend Maimonides, who writes, and I quote, "Shalom Chaim, what are your thoughts on the Iran-Contra scandal and how it compares to the Benghazi scandal," unquote. Well, I thought the Iran-Contra scandal was terrible. This is when the Reagan administration was giving weapons to Iran to get the release of a few hostages that the Iranians were holding. The Iranians were holding American hostages, and Caspar Weinberger and the other traitors in the Reagan administration were sending armed shipments, sophisticated weaponry, to the Iranian terrorist regime just to get the release of a few captive Americans. And of course, what the Iranians did is they'd release the Americans and then they'd take more captive. It was a terrible, terrible policy. But it doesn't compare to Benghazi. Because first of all, in Benghazi, 4 people were actually killed. And while they were being slowly murdered, Hillary Clinton and Barack Hussein Obama were aware of the fact that they were being murdered. There were dozens of CIA operatives in Libya who could have gone in to rescue them. There were Marines who could have gone in to rescue them. They ignored the cry of these 4 Americans and let the Muslim terrorists go in and slaughter them, and then tried to cover up the scandal by saying that there was a video involved and other things, and their only concern was how this would affect Obama's re-election campaign. So Barack Hussein Obama and Hillary Clinton murdered these 4 Americans and then covered it up, and to this day cover it up, So I think that's even worse than the Iran-Contra. The Iran-Contra scandal was terrible, but at least in the Iran-Contra scandal, people eventually came clean, and it was a terrible, insane thing that they did, but I can't make any excuses for it. It was absolutely awful what they did. But the Benghazi scandal was much worse. Much worse. I mean, here, I really believe that Obama and Hillary Clinton are just guilty of murdering these four people. They just knowingly let them get slaughtered when they could have saved them. They sat back and let them get slaughtered. I don't know how it could get worse than that. Thank you, Maimonides. And we now go to the great Kahana loyalist, who writes, and I quote, Dear Chaim, is there any online resource to listen to the Rav's Shiurim or Kahana Shiurim by other rabbis, unquote. And Shiurim means lessons. I don't know. There is something called Kahana Yomi. It's in Hebrew, though. There is a Hebrew thing called Kahana Yomi. I don't know if it's updated, but there was something where there were some lessons on there. I don't know how updated it is. I just don't know. You know, I've been so involved with so many other things now. We were very involved in this, and I was actually uploading their videos. I was taking their videos. They were recording this and sending it to me. And I was uploading it on YouTube. So some of the shiurim that were done were uploaded by me on some of our sites. Again, all of it is in Hebrew. The ones I saw and the ones I'm speaking about are all in Hebrew. I don't know. Other than that, I don't know. There may be some available. I just don't know. There are, as you know, Kahana loyalists, there are some pretty long lectures that the rabbi gave in English. Some pretty long lectures on YouTube. And some of them are really very important classic examples of the rabbi's teachings. Now, of course, the rabbi goes into much greater detail in his books. And if people who want to study his books online, and there should be videos of people studying his books online, that goes into much greater detail where they go chapter and verse. They go through the Torah and they explain what it means and explain how the rabbi explains these things in the Bible. Obviously, that would be, you know, that's something we could have hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of videos on. But I don't know if there's a place where that exists. It might be Kahana Yomi. Kahana Yomi, it's called. That, I think there are some videos with Kahana Yomi in Hebrew, but that's in Hebrew. Those are Hebrew lessons. In English, I don't know. I really don't know. Thank you, Kahana Loyalist. And we now go to the great Imaknik, who writes, what is your take on Dennis Prager, unquote. Dennis Prager condemned Rabbi Kahana, condemned the Kahanists. Just an example of the type of stuff. He doesn't speak Hebrew, but he was learning Arabic. He wanted to learn how to speak Arabic. I think he's a pathetic person. I think he's a pathetic person. I think he's obsessed with appeasing people and showing how fair and balanced and even-handed he is. And I think that that's a very dangerous thing once you get into that, because that means, in order to show how nice and fair and balanced and civilized you are, you're willing to allow your fellow Jews to be murdered if necessary. I mean, I want to be fair and balanced and even-handed and civilized. I want to be all of those things. But I don't care but if my fellow Jews are in danger, I don't care. I don't care what the New York Nazi Times or the Washington Nazi Post or the UN or anybody else is going to say. I'm going to do what I have to do to save my brothers and sisters. And I don't think Dennis Prager would do that. I know he wouldn't. In fact, Dennis Prager has said that he supports the creation of a so-called Palestine state, which is national suicide for Israel. So he's a negative force. Anyone who's in favor of a so-called Palestine state is negative for the Jewish people. That's bad for the Jewish people. That's someone who is going along with the enemies of the Jewish people and all the lies all the lies that there's a Palestinian people and all these other terrible things. We've got to fight against that. And anyone who supports that is a bad influence and a force for bad things for the Jewish people. Thank you, Imaknik. And I want to thank everybody for another program that I very much enjoyed doing. Until next week, Shalom.